the language of the assemblage of multiplicity, even in the way you described it. And Saskia is saying, seems to her that that's what it is. Dieter is sort of challenging you, is it? And Ian's saying, well, it doesn't make any difference anyway, sort of summarizing enormously. On the other hand, unpack that for us, because on the other hand, you have made a statement whether you're going to be the person who's doing it or not. Why do you think that your assembly of forms might or might not work better, despite what you've made very clear as a different position in terms of the association of form and function that maybe Frank has?
I think the ingredients here were in a way kind of very suggestive, because it is a kind of situation where nobody could ever develop the kind of tabula rasa, kind of large scale, deep and totalitarian kind of environment like Canary Wharf. So I think that what is beautiful about the site is that it has both an enormous scale but a limited depth, and that therefore it will always be part of the city, be permeated by the city, and kind of relate to the city in a very direct and inevitable manner. And I think that that enabled us to really think of it and with working within a very abstract repertoire of volumes in ways which I don't think only optically suggest richness or fragmentation, but actually produce a kind of real fragmentation, which is perhaps most generated by an engagement with every single remnant or element, whether it is infrastructure, history, or potential that exists there, or neighborhood or neighborship, such as the BBC.
I'd like to ask two of the designers in the room, Kees Christiansen and Alejandro Zairapolo, to perhaps comment on what has been said here, and also Nigel Hugill, as one of the other developers in the room that I at least recognize, you've been attacked as being risk-averse human beings. And after all, you started the White City Shopping Center, which is being, as Rem says, delivered to our door next year. And I'd like to come to you in a moment. But Kees Christiansen, and then Alejandro.
Yes. Maybe if we should, if we think of a kind of worst case, and we take this site and we say, okay, it's on the edge of the inner city, on the edge of city and periphery, it is connected by and accessed by motorways and railway stations, and we now have a certain pressure of real estate there. We could, in a kind of worst case concept, think of a kind of La Défense, a big ensemble of commercial development that would be probably be successful on this moment. And if we look at these kind of ensembles that are mostly already 20 years old, you see in the meantime that they are continuously revised, and that the relative success of this revision is rather dependent on the fact if there is a kind of connectivity potential in these sites, first of all, and secondly, if there's a certain plot grain of public space which is supporting this. And within this kind of situation, the question whether such a site is an ensemble, a kind of contained ensemble as such, or whether it is a catalyst for a kind of generation of more of this stuff in the surrounding, is more or less elusive. It's because you see that in these areas, the replacement even of existing buildings that are not even 25 years old is such an effortless intervention in this moment, that even, let's say, in a worst case situation, when there is a hardcore commercial program being implemented, it depends on the connectivity potential and of the plot grain quality, whether in a long term an ensemble of that might be successful or not, and potentially, depending on the economic life and social life of London, becomes a node or becomes an edge of a larger neighborhood, but that doesn't really matter.
Okay. Alejandro?
Yeah, maybe I would like to make...
Microphone, please. Press the button.
Sorry. I would like maybe to make two points. I think as much as I sympathize with the picture that REM has presented of architects or urban planners as slightly in a difficult position in terms of of being able to actually control the production of the city, I think that is also dangerous to avoid trying to give account of what are the reasons that you use to generate a scheme. And I think that is probably what maybe Frank was referring before. I think that once you put the scheme on the table, whether you believe that these reasons are right or not, or are real or not, you need to try to make an attempt to explain the orders that that you are trying to implement on the site. And then I think that the order of formal diversification is a dangerous one to use. Simply because, and this has almost political connotations. It seems to be everybody is claiming that London is a diverse city, and therefore plans that happen in London need to express that diversity. And I am not sure that if we keep enforcing diversity, we are going to contribute to the merging of those diversities. I think if you look at the problem of, for example, ethnic integration, Trevor Phillips, et cetera, there are kind of political parallels to this problem on the political side, in which somebody takes the position of trying to enhance diversification artificially, and that ends up creating chaos. I think maybe one of the most interesting problems that urban designers have today is actually to produce strategies of consistency or even sameness.
Okay. Rem, do you want to come?
Yes. I would find it dreadful if my presentation was understood as being in me claiming to be in a difficult position. I said that we are in a kind of very luxurious position to work for an ambitioned client in a very complex condition. And I was only indicating the limitations of our position without in any way being apologetic or limp about it. But I think it is important simply to indicate what then the plausible and strategic ambition is. I also don't think I was not given an account of the project, and I'm sorry again to be understood like that. And this is, of course, a 15-minute presentation. I think that we produced a document of maybe 2,000 pages. All of that argument, intricacy, et cetera, et cetera. And kind of finally, I find it kind of really completely surprising that the project is kind of seen as a contribution to chaos, because I think and anyone kind of seeing the kind of overall view must see that there is a kind of simultaneous commitment to rigor and to incident in the whole thing. I think it's the site is charged enough and kind of has a sufficiently compelling context to be in part influenced by that context. But I think the project and starting with the grid in itself was, you know, perhaps in proof of how we kind of started with sameness and how the project is, in our view, and very deliberately an independent statement based on a strong internal coherence, but inflected by context on all sides for kind of reasonably logical and compelling reasons.
As we bring this to a close in the next 5 minutes, I do want to try and wind this back to the issue that we started with, which was to use this as an opportunity to, in a way, investigate the notion of the work profile of London and what happens there. We've heard a number of points. And that's why I'd like to go to Nigel, in a way, at the micro scale. You have done developments in issues of sameness, of diversity, of risk, of difference, of knowing what you can sell now in 10 years is something you know about. And as a property developer, you've tried to break the mold. But I think a lot of the people in the room would say you certainly haven't gone far enough. And you'll say, well, I don't want to lose money. And I also want to come back to you, Bridget, at the end to say, does any of this matter, what we're saying? I mean, this is an issue for us as designers. And I do want to try and close on these two issues. Herman, we're not going to talk about transport in detail now. So, Nigel, could you respond to that?
Thank you. Actually, maybe a couple of personal anecdotes that help bring that through. I ran a company which, over the last 10 years, promoted the development of not only White City, but also Paddington Basin and Stratford City. And actually, we never lost money on any of those. We lost money when we tried to go into technology. So in the next 10 years, we're going to stick with property development. The second point is that, one of caution, is that I actually bought 6 land interests 8 years ago at White City on the when my wife was in labour having our third child. And I'm not sure if I hadn't been in that position whether the other landowners wouldn't have taken simply, it might have taken me a couple more years. And it goes to the point that's being made actually about the timescales, because this the retail part is the easy part of the site. And so that's, and it's coming out of the ground now. It'll be finished maybe the end of next year, maybe into the following year, which will basically be 10 years since I bought those land interests. But tying it to what I think it will really do for London, and a point that hasn't actually been made, but also goes to the way that we've tried to look at things, is that because of the value of the retail planning consent, the retail development will put about £150 million worth of new money into the public transport system. And it will involve building 2 new tube stations. And and in particular, one of those will be a very big access for new rail-based travel on the west side of London. And my guess is that that is actually the longest standing legacy that will be created. That will.
But Nigel, do you think? Sorry to interrupt. But do you think the scheme you've seen, right? Because you could be talking about any project at this point. The scheme you've seen, will it make any difference to the way that area would develop compared to a scheme that you might have commissioned?
I'm kind of with Ren that the marginal economics of that area to the north at the moment is pretty tough. I think it's difficult to speak of that in abstract terms. I think that Peter's right that the BBC hasn't had a major impact. It's had some impact, and therefore the bigger practical results will be that the shopping centre will ground further the BBC involvement, and I think ultimately that has to have a bigger impact. And just one last point, which is that I'm never wounded by the charge of conservatism, but in relation to the road, Peter will remember that actually we had to build that junction because of the fact that at that time it was part of the motorway network. Subsequently, we were able to get that road downgraded, and it no longer is a motorway. And that again will have a big long-term impact on that area. So I think those bones have got stronger because of what's happened.
So Bridget, Richard Sennett, and then Rem, I'll ask you to conclude. Microphone, please.
I think the point about timescales is very well made. The time it takes to get from here's a piece of space to development can be absolutely huge, and therefore the flexibility that you need in order to take advantage of what opportunities exist must also be huge. And I thought Rem's point was very well made, that, that in that process, the use to which you've put particular buildings change. That also applies to residential, and we have office buildings, a lot of office buildings now which have become residential, residential buildings, and the whole warehouse phenomenon, if you like, is part of that. But what matters in all of that, if you like, is the placemaking. So design and architecture, I think, matter hugely in the context of the placemaking which is around that and which then enables people to want to come and reuse your building in another form. So expect the reuse, and if you've got the right place, you'll get the reuse. Get the permeability, and people will be able to get into it to reuse it. So the street stuff that Peter was talking about is very important.
Richard Sennett?
I just observed that I think the connection between the visual and the economic here is very provoking, because if the world that both Frank and Bridget have described is in fact the future of jobs in London, then a project like this has to have lots of small-scale, different-sized, different-shaped objects. It's the only way that it can intersect with what's growing in the economy. And I think the challenge that Rem's team faces is how to create more fragmentation when you get a site of this size. Building more big blocks of form doesn't provide the kind of architecture that enables London to benefit from what's happening in modern capitalism.
Lots of people can occupy one block, though. We mustn't forget that.
Right. But they need to occupy it in different ways because they're doing lots of different things. There's a world of small offices, startups, companies that revise what they do, etc. And Rem's challenge is how, I think Alejandro is exactly on the wrong track about this, how to have more fragmentation, more difference, more dissimilarity. That's where you intersect with modern capitalist economy.
And with the city, with the larger city.
Rem.
I would like to say something kind of, maybe not so much in response, but more as a kind of conclusion of our kind of work here. In the beginning of our project, a year ago, we felt that we were involved in a very typical situation. And that was before, when we had met the landowners, but when we, before we met the borough and before we met the GLA. What has been extremely interesting for us to see is that apparently in the last 5 years, the kind of caricature of the landowner proceeding unchecked and getting away with, et cetera, is now seriously refined, and in fact, I have been impressed, and I think that's true for you too, Wanneer, how serious the involvement of the other parties was, but also how they, how the world of politics has no longer able to really initiate projects, has been able to develop a repertoire of influence and control that has a very deep influence on the project. And so in that sense, that has been for us, I guess, a very positive, not only experience, but also discovery, that somehow the play between the market and the world of politics, at least in London, seems vital and efficient, productive, let's say.
I'd like to everyone for to join me in thanking Bridget Rosewall, Rem Koolhaas, and Rainier de Graaf, who sat there silently, but I know worked a lot on this, and all the respondents, so if you could join me in thanking them. Two, three other quick things. We're going to have coffee next door, and we're running 1/4 hour late, so can you come back here at 4:30? Just bring your coffee. here so that we can continue. One moment. There is a dinner tonight at the Whopping Food restaurant. Now, you're all invited, but we need to know who's coming. Can you put your hands up? Right, add some more plates. That's good. All right. And the last thing is, John Ross mentioned before that he wanted to show this video, which we're going to show in a moment. He's also going to spend 30 seconds introducing it. Those of you who want to start having coffee, go ahead. But John, the floor is yours.
I want to show this because I thought the presentation this morning on London's economic policy did not quite get to the most essential matter. This is the presentation that we did for the Olympics. It is not about sport. I'm not showing you how we won the Olympics. I mean, it is about sport, but the essence is not about it. It is the best presentation I know of how we see the future of London. You will see it is very strange presentation in one feature. There is not a single shot of London on it, except on a small black and white television screen at the back. But it is the best presentation image of London that we have. I'm sorry, it is in two parts. The whole thing's about 5 minutes because it started and ended the presentations that were made for the Olympics. So this is the...
To make an Olympic champion takes 8 Olympic finalists. To make an Olympic finalist takes 80 Olympians. To make an Olympian takes 202 national champions. To make a national champion takes thousands of athletes. To make an athlete takes millions of children around the world inspired to choose sport.
He is the 2012 Olympic champion.
La final de London 2012. Y muy veloz lo que está haciendo el hombre que cierra, Andrew Bailey. Y el último tiempo para Australia, 56.31.
Лондон. Соревнование на 100 метров баттерфляем. И старт! На половине дистанции вперед вырывается Эрик Ловас. Он чуть-чуть опережает Стива Джонса и Джастина Магнуса. Гонка идет между Джонсоном и Ловасом. Последний раз, 100 метров, похоже, Ловас. Зрители в Лондоне.
Thank you.
London, he is the 2012 Olympic champion.